Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 26th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Eucharist, Learning Table Manners in a Broken World. This installment is A Sacrifice of Praise, a Healing Church in a Mutilated World, based on 1 Corinthians 11:24. Presented in the Fireside Room by Mark Burrows. Let's listen in.
Betrayal, I think, is an important thing for us to reflect on in our own lives as Christians. And I think that fact remains with us every time we gather at the table. The question really is, what kind of memory of Jesus are we going to cultivate? What kind of presence are we going to invoke and hope to find? So we began with an image of betrayal from the novel, Beloved by Toni Morrison. And this morning early, we thought about the church as a hungering place, as a place that discovers its identity in a meal, in a gift of a meal. And we watched a section from this extraordinary film by the novelist, the writer Isaac Dinesen, Babette's Feast. Some of you are here this morning, and many of you probably have seen the film, which is a story about a community that has lost its joy, it's lost its hope, it's lost its delight. And it's this feast, this extravagant feast, that awakens these ancient memories of love and of joy and of sacrifice, of commitment among these people who become bitter and tired and hopeless. So that was early this morning when he had given thanks, Thanksgiving. This morning, in this session, I want to think with you about a healing church in a mutilated world. It's a strong title. And by the end of the hour, we're going to look at a poem by a remarkable contemporary poet, a living poet named Adam Zagajewski, called To praise, what happens exactly? Try to praise the mutilated world. Try to praise the mutilated world. A poem that he wrote after 9/11 that is really shapes itself around what it means to praise in the midst of terror, and in the midst of violence, and in the midst of loss, which is probably the only place it really counts. It's easy to praise when it's a beautiful day like this in Holden Village, and we're healthy and we're well fed and we're happy to be here. And it's a much harder thing to attempt to praise by the rivers of Babylon, to remember the old songs and try to sing them again. I want to think with you first about As I get older in my life, I'm more convinced that the only way we really understand the gospel is through poetry. Well, not just written poetry, but the ways we express ourselves incompletely, which is one of the gifts of poetry. If you think about a book of poems, it's one of the most inefficient forms of publishing we know, because mostly we have empty pages. If you look at a page of poetry, it's mostly blank. Unlike almost all of our Bibles, which are printed from one edge all the way to the other, there's no room to breathe, there's no margin to write in, there's nothing you can do but maybe underline. Well, a poem needs room to breathe. And our faith needs room to breathe. Our life as Christians, we need margins. We need big margins. We need margins that aren't cluttered with speech and affirmations and declarations and proclamations and imperatives and admonitions. All the things that we do so easily with each other. Paul, but in the middle of this letter to the Corinthians, he says that the kingdom, the reign of God, depends not on talk, but on power. That's a phrase that, when I first read it, just arrested me. That the reign of God, the presence of God, the work of God, the liturgy of God, that's what liturgy means, it's work, right? The liturgy, the work of God, depends not on talk, but on power. That if our theology is only about getting the talk right, then we've done nothing right yet. Because that's only the barest beginning. The question is, what do we do with the talk about God? How do we incarnate the body of Christ? That was where we began yesterday. How does the body of Christ take shape? How does it find presence among us? That's Paul's deep question. I mean, really, the letters to the Corinthians are fundamentally about the body, the human body, the suffering body, the sinning body, the failing body. And this image he has of what it is to be in the body of Christ. And really, when Paul talks about communion in 1 Corinthians, it's framed by an image of what church should look like. And that's where we'll come to by Friday, if you follow along before. But first then, just a poem. It's again by Mary Oliver, a living poet, a resident of my state of Massachusetts. Or maybe I should say I'm a resident of her state. She's been there a lot longer than I have. From a book of poems called The Leaf and the Cloud. And this is a book written after she turned 60. And it's a kind of introspective book, thinking about the wisdom at the end of life, about what it is to face one's last part of life, and how we find beauty, and how we find dignity, and how we find grace, mercy, in this harvest of our lives. So here's just a page from this marvelous poem. It may be, she writes, it may be the rock in the field is also a song. It's a strange way to begin a poem. It may be that the rock in the field, have you ever thought about rocks being a song? They're alive, you know, rocks. That's one thing you discover in the mountains here. My children have been asking, you know, what's a slide? Where does gravel come from? How do we? You're halfway up to Heart Lake, and you come on this sandy patch of trail. Where does sand come from? Mm-hmm. Way up in the mountains. Did they bring, my youngest daughter, did they bring it here to make the trail smooth? No, it's the way the earth works. It's this breaking down of rock, this fracturing of stone, which is at the very heart of the geological movements of the earth. So here it is. It may be the rock in the field is also a song. And it may be the ears of corn swelling under their green sleeves are also songs. And it may be the river glancing and leaning against the dark stone is also a deliberate music. So I will write my poem, but I will leave room for the world. So I will write my poem, but I will leave room for the world. I will write my poem tenderly and simply, but I will leave room for the wind combing the grass, for the feather falling out of the grouse's fantail and fluttering down like a song. And I will sing for the bones of my wrists, supple and exemplary, and the narrow paths of my brain, its lightnings and issues, its flags, its ideas, and the mystery of the number 3. And I will sing for the iron doors of the prison, and for the broken doors of the poor, and for the sorrow of the rich who are mistaken and lonely. And I will sing for the white dog forever tied up in the orchard. And I will sing for the morning sun and its panels of pink and green on the quiet water, and for the loons passing over the house. I will sing for the spirit of Luke, her beloved dog who died. I will sing for the spirit of Luke. I will sing for the ghost of Shelley, poet who committed suicide. I will sing for the Janes and their careful brooms. You know the Janes who sweep the trails in front of them so they don't crush an ant or kill any creature? It's a good thing they need to know about microorganisms. I will sing for the salt and the pepper in their little towers on the clean table. I will sing for the rabbit that has crossed our yard in the moonlight, stopping twice to stamp the cold ground with his narrow foot. I will sing for the 2 coyotes who came at me with their strong teeth, and then, at the last moment, began to smile. I will sing for the veil that never lifts. I will sing for the veil that begins once in a lifetime, maybe, to lift. I will sing for the rent in the veil. I will sing for what is in front of the veil, the floating light. I will sing for what is behind the veil, light, light, and more light. This is the world, and this is the work of the world. if you only wrote one poem, and it was that one, it would be enough, really, as a poet. This remarkable way, Mary Oliver, of the poets I know, is a poet who always lives toward a place of gratitude. She doesn't always get there, and this poem is textured. It's not just about the beautiful soft light of a morning sun, sunrise. It's about the prison doors and the poor and learning to praise things that are difficult realities in our world. And I think what I'd like to think with you about this morning is what it means to make a sacrifice of praise. I'm not Lutheran, but I checked the Lutheran Book of Worship, and at least in this version, there's a line from the ancient medieval Mass that gets into the Anglican prayer book through Cranmer, through the Reformer, Cranmer, so it's in the Book of Common Prayer. And maybe you Lutherans can help me if it's somewhere in the liturgy and I just missed it. But this phrase that comes from the Middle Ages, from the late 12th century, it's added to the liturgy, about how we make a sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving. Is that line familiar to Lutherans?
Yes.
Is it in the Lutheran? Where,
yes.
Where is it? Where does it fall?
My first impression is that it's in Matins, but but maybe.
Okay, so it's not in the Eucharistic liturgy.
It's the refrain of a hymn.
It's a phrase that has a deep resonance in the Christian tradition. That is my point. And
yeah.
Anglicans pray it every time before the prayer of consecration, before the words of institution and the prayer of consecration, that we bring the praise, a sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving. And there's something powerful. Sacrifice, first of all. What does it mean? What's the word mean? What is sacrifice? What does it mean to sacrifice?
Give till it hurts.
Give till it hurts. Interesting way of putting it. To give until it hurts. There's a loss, something that you give up in the sacrifice, something that you give over. The word itself means to make holy. Sacra ficiu is to make something holy. And in the tradition, you're quite right, there's often pain associated with sacrifice. We think of sacrificing animals. And of course, in the letter to the Hebrews, Jesus is portrayed as the end of sacrifice. There's been a huge, very rich conversation in the last 20 years among theologians about the image of sacrifice, particularly around the character of René Girard. Some of you may know René Girard's work about sacrifice.
Are you looking for the word consecrate?
Sorry?
Consecrate.
Consecrate.
Yeah.
Consecrate. To make something. To make it holy. Yes. To make it, to be with the holy making. To consecrate. Yeah. But sacrifice, it involves, Helen, your point's right, it involves pain, it involves giving something, giving up something. To speak of a sacrifice of praise, what would that mean then? These are words that are strange to put together. To make a sacrifice of praise. What would a sacrifice of praise look like?
Praise when you don't want to praise.
Praise when you don't want to praise. When it's hard.
When it hurts.
When it hurts.
How can our giving something up make something holy?
That's a great question.
I don't have anything that's going to make anything else holy. Sacrifice you need to make holy. Me giving something up.
Let's think with you about that a bit. When do we give something up that brings some kind of holiness into the world? Let's think of very concrete images. What do we do?
Well, like Lent.
Lent?
Give up something.
Okay, we give things up. Why? Why would we give things up?
To be changed.
To be changed. We make room. We empty ourselves. We create space.
So I see when we accept limits, for example, on our future sexual partners, you have to choose one. There's a certain element of sacrifice, but it also makes something that we take to be holy, holier. If we did it.
So limitations, it's partly also about limiting.
Sort of, and I think I'm wondering about sacrifice of praise. It means don't praise me. Praise
mm-hmm.
God.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But let's keep it for the moment on earth. I mean, that's right. We'll get to there.
Right.
I think that's important. I have two teenage daughters. One of them is looking at colleges. I'm thinking about sacrifice all the time. I have to. I can't live my life with an exuberant expenditure of whatever little money I have, because I'm looking at their future and saying, how can I assure that they have the opportunities that I had? Or maybe ones I didn't have.
You're making it better, but to me that's not holy. I mean, I when I'm thinking holy, I'm thinking beyond what I can do.
And that's our natural inclination, is to think beyond, to think of spiritual things. And mm-hmm. I'd like to remind us, at least in the simple word, sacrifice, isn't necessarily reflecting away from our reality here. But the urgency of your point is absolutely right. What I'd like to think with you now, continue the thought a little bit further, what other sacrifices do we make in our life that maybe hurt or that deny a joy? I mean, you talked about mm-hmm. sexual choices mm-hmm. that deny possible joys for the sake of something good. What other sacrifices, what other simple ones do we make?
I think of parents who have a disabled child from birth and know that this is going to be a lifelong commitment, and how it just changes the whole of
that's
one's
powerful.
Life.
I mean, there have been many moving times here for me this week, but one was serving communion on Sunday evening, and a family came forward with a severely handicapped boy,
yep.
man, I don't know who he was. And he had the bread, his bread, mm-hmm. was all wrapped up in a little, you know, in a little paper napkin. And he carefully opened it, standing, everybody had to wait. Do you know who he was?
Yeah, he's from our congregation.
Beautiful. I mean, it was such a beautiful moment. I assume it was his parents with him?
Yes. Well, it's his mother.
So was it Aaron?
No.
But he opened this up, and he very carefully ate each crumb before he took a cup. And then receive the juice.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for me an overwhelming moment.
Yeah.
It was
gluten-free
bread.
Uh-huh.
There it is.
Oh.
Yeah.
He knew why he was there, and he knew what he needed to do to make mm-hmm. the sacrifice.
That's very sweet.
At this point, just looking at all of these different things, my own thought now is the holiness of the sacrifice. I don't see it as being beyond,
mm-hmm.
you know, as being heavenly mm-hmm. or something. I was mm-hmm. just thinking about her point. And I think the holiness of the sacrifices, for example, what he said, having a child, a handicapped child,
mm-hmm.
and knowing that this is going to be a lifelong struggle.
Right.
And I think by making the choice that I'm going to stick by my child in the eyes of God, that is holiness.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's for me, because
there's something of faithfulness, of fidelity in sacrifice, of staying there. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Maybe this probably isn't where we're going to go right now, but the thought hit me is, you know, the things that I was thinking about, the small things. I do some informal mentoring of a
mm-hmm.
refugee family, you know, so I'm taking time that
mm-hmm.
I could have used other times to spend
sure.
with them.
Sure.
And visiting family who are a long way away, you know, the expense of travel to eat, you know, to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But the thought that just hit me, connected perhaps with yesterday, with the community idea,
mm-hmm.
is that it's the idea of giving up something of ourselves
mm-hmm.
for the benefit
yes.
of the community,
yes.
of the collective.
This is where we're moving.
Okay.
And it's where Paul is moving. In point of fact, that's one of the reasons that I chose this text from 1 Corinthians and not from the Gospels, because Paul is writing a letter to a community of people who are deeply divided. We're divided by, we don't know what the divisions are. We know that there are these different leaders in the community, Apollo and all of these folks that he mentioned in the first chapter. Some follow Christ, some follow Paul, some follow Apollo. But in the 11th chapter, there's something else that's going on. It's a class division, that some, the wealthy remain wealthy, the poor remain poor. And when they come together to eat a meal, which apparently was what happened, they ate a meal before they broke the bread. The rich brought their own meal and ate it themselves. And the poor were left with nothing. And so they came to the table hungry, and the wealthy came sated and probably a little bit drunk, a little bit tipsy. And Paul says, this is a shame. So eventually, by Friday, I mean, you're steering us toward Friday. Really, what's so compelling about this to me is, as Christians, as I said yesterday, we only have one world. And in one sense, if we can think liturgically in a very different way than we normally do, there really is only one table. There's only one table that we all eat at. And the question is, that Paul asks, will we wait for each other? Will we bring the poor to the table and share our meal with them? Not because it's a duty. Not even because it limits us. It actually expands us. This is where it's a different kind of sacrifice. It's not just something we give up. I never think about the loss of what I'm doing when I'm saving money for my daughters to go to college. I don't think the parent of a handicapped child is constantly thinking of all the things they could be doing, because they're attending with love to the one act of generosity and gift that they can give. They're not thinking about the loss. They're thinking about the gift. They're thinking about the gift. That's really, I think, what Paul is trying to say about communion. It's thinking about the gift. It's putting the gift at the center of the sacrifice. That Jesus, after all, took bread and gave it for us, for you. So we're moving a bit ahead. Let me come back. And I want to think with you about this image now of brokenness, because that's at the heart of the meal. To me, when I was a student minister, I was working in a Presbyterian church, and it was an experience. It was a different culture for me. Very orderly, very proper. You know, Presbyterians do everything decently and in order, following St. Paul, and they do, as you know. Any Presbyterians here? No? Okay. Anyway, the minister at the church, the first Sunday we had communion together, showed me how it was to be done. And you took the loaf of bread and you cut it through, except, you know, one little bit, and you put, and then you pressed it back together and you put it on the table. And at the moment of the fracture, as it's called in the medieval church, the fraction, breaking the bread, he said, this is my body broken for you, and bing. We had perfect two loaves, cut perfectly down the middle. I knew there was something wrong with it. Physically. I knew there was something physically, not theologically. Well, theologically too. It was too neat. It was too Western. It was too hygienic. And as he put it, well, otherwise you get crumbs on the floor. You know, he was very worried about crumbs on the floor. God bless him. A wonderful man and a wonderful minister. But that moment, I knew that there was something wrong with that image. That there ought to be, probably, a struggle to break the bread. It ought to be as messy as life is messy, as difficult and even painful as life is difficult and painful for us. That breaking the one loaf, and this is the drama of this image. I mean, one of the earliest Christian prayers we have, it's probably a prayer that's in your liturgy, whether you're Lutheran, it gets into one of the UCC, my church, and one of our prayers. It comes from the Didache. It's about the bread that was scattered on many hills becomes one loaf. And in Eucharist, we have to break that one loaf. You can't feed a community without breaking the bread, without fracturing the loaf. And there's a drama there of violence, really. We do violence to the one loaf so that we can feed the many. A sacrifice, a pulling apart. So I want to hold that thought in mind. We're going to look at this poem by Adam Zagajewski. And it comes back, I think, Paul, you said it. It's sacrifice is a praise in difficult circumstances, in difficult places, in difficult times. This poem, as I said, was written after 9/11. In the winter of 2002, it was first published in the New Yorker. So you may have seen it there if you read the New Yorker. It came from a time of, I don't know, what were you feeling in that winter? Can you remember the images? Can you forget the images? Can any of us forget the images? I have to say to you, when I began to hear news email almost immediately from my friends in the third world, the first thing that they expressed was sympathy. And as the weeks and months progressed, they expressed increasing distaste for what was happening, what they saw happening in our country. And that was a sense that somehow this was the only moral outrage that was worth worrying about. In a world where, in fact, during the hour we sit here, another 1,500, mostly children, will die of starvation. Where 1 billion of the planet's almost 7 billion inhabitants are living at the edge of starvation right now, today. I mean, so they became, the sympathy passed fairly quickly, and I began to hear from my friends from the Southern Hemisphere particularly, a sense of wondering about the moral compass of the American church. Why was there nothing else? Why was there no other word coming than arming ourselves and retaliation and vengeance? It's still, I think, a very profound question for us to ask. And it's where we'll end up this week, where we'll think about what it is to share a table with our enemies. Jesus tells us we ought to do it. And we'll think about that on Friday together. But here's this poem. It comes from the winter of 2002. I'd like to read it. Please. Sir.
Try to praise the mutilated world, remember June's long days and wild strawberries, drops of rosé wine, the nettles that methodically overgrow the abandoned homesteads of exiles. You must praise the mutilated world. You watched the stylish yachts and ships. One of them had a long trip ahead of it, while salty oblivion awaited others. You've seen the refugees going nowhere. You've heard the executioner sing joyfully. You should praise the mutilated world. Remember the moments when we were together in a white room and a curtain fluttered. Return in thought to the concert where music flared. You gathered acorns in the park in autumn and leaves eddied over the earth's scars. Praise the mutilated world. And the gray feather a thrush lost, and the gentle light that strays and vanishes and returns.
Thank you so much. This is an amazing poem, as much for what it simply evokes as for what it says. But most of you probably read this or heard it for the first time. What would you make of it? A string of images, you read it beautifully. This refrain that keeps coming back. Try to praise the mutilated world. Try to praise the mutilated world. First, try to praise the mutilated world.
I think of Iraq.
Think of Iraq. Yeah.
The struggling the children. People. Mm-hmm. I mean, this isn't the city being mutilated, this is the countryside being mutilated.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's not a war poem in that sense.
It's destroying the...
It begins, though, with such beauty, right? I mean, try to praise mutilated, well, then this whole series of images, June's long days, wild strawberries, drops of rosé wine, and the nettles that methodically overgrow the abandoned homesteads of exile. Suddenly, we're in this moral ambiguity. Suddenly, we're not thinking about the tender beauty of June and strawberries and wine, but we're thinking about nettles overgrowing homes, the abandoned homesteads of exiles, people who've been forced.
Refugees.
Mm-hmm. Refugees. You watch the stylish yachts and ships, beautiful, but you know that some will be destroyed by the power or the violence of the ocean. You've seen the refugees going nowhere. You've heard the executioners sing joyfully. And the images that flooded our media of Abu Ghraib, of smiling soldiers with Iraqis' heads under feet, crushing their hands and heads and feet, lashing them to leashes, urinating on them. You should praise. How do you praise? How do you praise a world like this? How? This is Adam's question. How in the world? You can try, but how are we going to praise a broken world like this? And then this series of tender memories. Remember the moments when we were together in the white room and the curtain fluttered. Return in thought to the concert where music flared. And the simple image. You read it so lovely, in a lovely way. You gathered acorns in the park in autumn, and leaves eddied over the earth's scars. And these last lines, praise the mutilated world and the gray feather a thrush lost, and the gentle light that strays and vanishes in the tears. What do you make of this poem? If you say, Paul, that praise matters most when it's hardest, maybe the sacrifice is largest there, why do it? Why not become cynical? Why not turn away with disgust? Why not become politically disengaged? Why not blame someone? God, Bush, the Iraqis themselves, Saddam? Blame is easy. Why not do that? What's this call to praise? In the real world of loss and of struggle, why? Why praise in that world?
I think if you don't, you just let it stay the way it is.
If you don't, what happens to you when you let it stay the way it is?
You lose your joy.
You lose your joy? Yeah?
And then sometimes there's a feeling of evil overcoming.
Yes.
If you just sit and allow it to be that way, I'm speaking from my own experience.
Yes.
Not ever wanting to praise in the midst of pain and suffering and heartache. And then you find yourself feeling more like the people who made you to feel that way.
Yes.
And you are like entrapped, like the lights up there, surrounded by all of those things. You feel entrapped. And the only time you really encounter that kind of freedom, physically, spiritually, emotionally, is when you gather that ability to praise that unknown being who sees it all.
So it's finding a strength that you might not otherwise have.
Yes. Or else you just end up being like these people.
Yeah. That's the point. Otherwise you simply become what you hate very easily. And when Paul writes to the Roman Christians in the 12th chapter, where he begins to talk about, again, the one body, the same image comes back, the one body, you're many members of one body. And he begins to say that we should really extend hospitality to the stranger. We should love our enemies. And remember what he says, do not overcome evil with evil, but overcome evil with good, with good. That in a way, that's an act of praise. Overcoming evil with evil is sheer vengeance. And the Bible is fairly clear. Jesus was clear. Paul is clear. Texts from Deuteronomy are very clear that vengeance is not our work. It doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative. Vengeance is not our work. Why? Not because it's morally wrong only. I think it comes to what one of you said. You become what you hate with vengeance. And this happens not just on the grand scale. It happens on those small person-to-person scale where we despise someone's gift because it's not what we want or what we need or what we think they should give. It happens in families. It poisons communities. It happened in the community we saw this morning in Babette's Feast. This community of good Christian people who'd lost the way because they no longer knew about the sacrifice of praise in this life. And as we saw at the end of that movie, this powerful scene, where there, some of you were here, have the rest of you all seen it? Yeah. Where they're leaving, Babette never comes out of the kitchen. The cook never comes out of the kitchen. Interesting. When they're leaving, they thank each other, and they're thanking each other in a way so different from when they come. Bitter, full of their petty resentments, full of their animosities toward each other, all natural things, all the little vengeances that they were carrying, all the little angers that were gnawing away at them, and that reduced them to nothing. That they lose themselves, it's not quite the way you said it, Lima, but in a way you lose your dignity. You lose your dignity by losing the capacity to praise, by giving it away. I think, yeah, please, Helen.
When you were asking about small sacrifices a while ago, the thing that came to my mind after we got through talking about that was that one of the things that perhaps we need to sacrifice is just ideas that we hold.
Yeah.
And I think, I can't remember who was it, said there's no wall like an idea.
Yeah.
And if, you know, our expectations are such that people should behave in a certain way. And
right.
I find my own self, it takes a lot of energy to judge all the people around me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think they ought to be doing what they ought to be doing. Mm-hmm. They don't, they do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think a sort of a daily sacrifice or moment of sacrifice is just to give up, just to be open to whatever it is.
I said it eloquently. I think you've just given a beautiful kind of interpretation of that line from 1 Corinthians 4, that the reign of God depends not on talk, you say of ideas, but on power. Power is very, very different than ideas or talk. Not that ideas don't have power. I get paid to teach ideas. I'm very aware of that. But the ideas themselves will not change a community. That's something I'm becoming more aware of as I get older. When I was a young graduate student, the wisest professor I had in seminary, who taught the class that I most despised before I took it, was a class in church administration. I thought, I'm going to be an academic. I'm an intellectual. What do I need a course in church administration for? It's the best class I ever had, bar none. And this very wise man, a man named Hansen, Guy Geddes Hansen, the only African-American on the faculty, pulled me aside one day and he said, you know, Mark, you believe that ideas will change people, don't you? And I said, well, yeah, what else do we have, right? He said, well, I'll talk to you again in 30 years. It's almost time for me to have this conversation again. Because he's so right, Helen, ideas by themselves, talk, can become our biggest obstacle. I found in my life that the most ungenerous community of people I spend time with are academics. The most ungenerous group. Because our ideas are everything to us. We can't allow another person to have an idea more eloquent than ours. The compliments that I've received, or even given, I have to say, are so small in the academic community. It's sobering. And I hear this from pastors talking about their relationships with each other. I'm a pastor, but I don't live in the world of pastors in the same way that some of you, you're a Lutheran pastor and other pastors. But there's something about us that makes it difficult for us to break through our commitment to ideas. Even good ideas. Even the right ideas. Yeah. Yeah, please.
Could we just name some ways then by which we can bring this power?
Yes.
Naturally we think about just loving people, but can we be even more precise or proactive?
Yeah, thank you. That's where we're going. And this morning we talked about this in the session. One of the things that I've become increasingly aware of as I'm trying to reconstruct for myself what the early Christian practice must have been like of this sacrament, which they didn't call the sacrament, they called it a mystery of God. The Latin translation is sacramentum, but that's not his word. At the heart of this mystery is a certain kind of memory. And in Babette's feast, at the very beginning of the meal, as they start to drink this amontillado, this beautiful liqueur, this sweet wine, aperitif that you drink before a meal, as they begin to drink this, do you remember the image? The general says, amontillado, he knows what it is. And they begin to remember the old pastor who died, and the gift of his graciousness to them. The way he welcomed the sinful ones and gave them a home gave them dignity, gave them a place to become Christian. And the one old man says, when I remember meeting the minister for the first time, I was a quarrelsome, difficult man, but I've tried to become a good Christian. It's a beautiful moment. And in a way, memory in this scene is the heart of the kind of redemption. They begin to remember their first love, which is the only love that's the deepest love. We never lose it. I'm convinced of this. Oh, we love different people in our lives, but the first time we're awakened by love defines us. It shapes us. It shapes the capacity of our heart. And yes, it will be broken. And yes, it will be disappointed, even betrayed. But it's that first opening of the heart that defines us as human creatures. Tell me, Mary Alba writes, how she said this beautiful line, tell me. Therefore, tell me, what will engage you? What will open the dark fields of your mind like a lover at first touching? That's beautiful. What will open the dark fields of your mind? I sometimes think that would be a good call to worship. What would open the dark fields of our minds like a lover at first touching? Like the first time someone names you and really names you, looks at you and says, Helen. The first time Jim named you in love. The first time someone, when we're children, sees us. When someone stoops down and genuinely sees us. The children get the best books. They really do. And in the little library, my children were sleeping and we're all kind of in one room, so they told me, Dad, you're going to get up early tomorrow. Don't study in the room, you know. So I'm in the little children's library, this beautiful memorial library. And there's a beautiful poster on the wall. It's from a children's book, I don't know which one. It's something about how, you know, take the hand of a child and find a little corner and read. It's beautifully said. I'm sorry I'm learning it, but there's something about the time a child is, we remember it, the first time an adult who doesn't have to do it, you know, your parents have to do it, whether they do or don't, they have to do it. The first time an adult notices you, listens to you, hears you, it's unforgettable. I can name that time for me. Can you name it? Can you think of a time, a teacher, perhaps, or an aunt, your grandmother? I'm naming women, could be men too. What if this was the opening of worship? Tell me, what will engage you? What will open the dark fields of your mind like a lover at first touching? What a question. What a question. I mean, that to me, that's the heart. That's the heart of the faith. It's why I keep coming back to church, even when I know that I'll often be disappointed, because I know that there's the possibility that, and it's not the fault of the liturgy, or of the preacher, or of the even of the community. It's usually my fault. It's usually my fault that I haven't brought a mind ready to be open. I'm clinging to my ideas. I'm deciding what the liturgy should look like. Darn it! And when I don't hear that one word, or see it done in the right way, or see it done by the wrong person, whether it's a she or a gay or a black or a white or a green or a purple, whatever, then I close down. Tell me, what will engage you? What will open the dark fields of your mind like a lover at first touching? That's an invitation to a sacrifice of praise. So I began by saying I think that our faith is fundamentally poetry. And I want to end with a little musing on that and invite you to think with me about it. Paul and I were talking after breakfast this morning about something we might do. And it would be a wonderful Holden thing to do. It won't happen this week, but maybe another week or another year. Well, the idea, the challenge, the invitation, to find scripture that keeps us alive. The memorized one, not the one in the book that we have to go look for. No, we each carry in us a living word, if we're alive in faith. And it may only be a few words. It may be the 23rd Psalm, it may be a line from Jesus, it may be a line from the liturgy, or from a hymn. Actually, it may often be a line from a hymn, because those are the ones we actually memorize. Those are the ones that we sing over and over again, and you know, as you get older, you just don't need the hymn book anymore. I'm very involved in a Benedictine community near Boston, and the old monks, they don't have to use the Psalter anymore. For many of us, not for the praying through 15 psalms at a time, but for the first service of the day, the vigil service, which is always the same, and for the compline and vespers, which are always the same psalms, they don't need the book. They know the psalms. And to watch them standing, just letting the psalms come out, is an image to me of what the scriptures are meant to be. So what would happen to us if we took this sacrifice of praise, and if we gathered together whatever we know that keeps us alive in our faith, not the ones we look for in the book, but the ones that are inscribed on our hearts, and gather them at the table, or gather them around the lectern, around the pulpit, and that became our holy word, holy wisdom, holy word. Albert goes here, holy wisdom, holy word. In a way, I think this is really what Adam Zagajewski is getting at. How do we reach down, not to the place of our feelings only, but to the place of a deeper praise. A praise that has a deeper memory, a deeper resilience, and probably most of all, a deeper courage. A deeper courage. Thinking of times in your life where you've been by the river of Babylon, whatever that was for you, where you've been exiled, some of you I know, physically exiled, from homeland, from family, from familiar things that you love. How do we sing the songs of Zion? How do we bring the words of praise in those dark seasons of our lives, those difficult places of our lives? One strange, marvelous poet, mystic, man who took the name Angelus Silesius, 17th century character, wrote a little poem, four lines. He wrote little poems. That's one of the reasons I love him. He wrote a lot of little poems, almost all, two lines or four lines. God, whose love and joy are present everywhere, can't come to visit you unless you aren't there. The deep paradox here, so to take a minute, God, whose love and joy are everywhere, can't come to visit you unless you aren't there. What does it mean? God, whose love and joy are everywhere, can't come to visit you unless you aren't there. What do you think? Took me a while, too.
You have to let it go before God can. I mean, you can't be God.
You can't be God.
You can't be God as long as you're, I'm me and it's my, once I give that up, then God can come.
Okay. You can't be God. I think that's a vital part of it. What else might this little poem say?
You can't fill an empty, you can't fill a full picture.
You can't, that's a great image. You can't fill a full picture. In one sense, that's what the Babette's Feast is about. You can't fill a full picture. I mean, these people find they're emptied of their natural joy, of the joy of just, the joy of the familiar wonder of having this marvelous minister and this beautiful community, tight-knit, loving community. When that finally falls away, it seems for some of them that there's no hope anymore. And that becomes the place where they actually have the appetite for the feast, but they have to discover the appetite. It's not what we have or don't have. It's really about our hunger. You can't fill a full pitcher. That's a great image. Can't fill a full pitcher. So in the middle of this story of communion is an image of breaking, which seems to be the end of the story for the first disciples. And they abandoned Jesus, all of them, except the women. Except the women. But the men, the ones who had were named, who had privilege and power in the community of the followers, all betrayed Jesus, all of them, because they think the story is over. And I love the ending of Mark's gospel, the oldest version we have. I mentioned this on Monday, which ends with the disciples trembling and in fear. And later, apparently a later version, adds a resurrection scene, but Mark's gospel leaves us at a place of terror, of fear, of uncertainty, of thinking that this full picture had been shattered and there could be nothing brought back to it. And I think that's natural for us as human beings, as Christians, but probably as humans. We think that when the story is over, that there's nothing left, that there can be no epilogue, no final scene. Another American poet, Wallace Stevens, in one of my favorite poets' poems, it begins this way: after the final no, there comes a yes. After the final no, there comes a yes. And on that yes, the future of the world depends. After the final no, and I think this is really, as Christians, we live in this sacrament at the presence of the final no. We don't think of it that way often. We think of it as a resurrection moment or as a festival of the community. But in the early Christian community, this was remembering the final no. After the final no, there comes a yes. And on that yes, the future of the world depends. To me, communion is nothing less than that risk and that sacrifice. And so what we'll do in the days that lie ahead of us tomorrow, we're going to move into a very different place and think about the framing of the story. And we're going to use a song by Bruce Springsteen, which was inspired by 9/11 and by the events that have transpired since then, by the culture of fear that our nation has become. And he wrote a song, some of you have heard it, maybe all of you on the radio, Devils and Dust. We'll hear that song, which I think is, it doesn't give the solution, but it certainly portrays the problem, the desperate problem that we find ourselves in as a nation and as a world. That if we live at the place of our fear, if our gospel is simply a way of fortifying ourselves against our enemies, then we will have no hope. No hope of any redemption, anything like redemption, or at least anything like Jesus' redemption. So we'll think tomorrow about fear and about what it is to be a church that lives in the midst of wounds. And we'll do that in with the chorus of Lima's reflections on Liberia and West Africa, and with Barbara's reflections on apocalypse, images of apocalypse and terror. And then on Friday, we'll take the day off Thursday and Friday, we'll think about this claim from the psalm that thou hast prepared a table before me in the presence of my enemies. What it means to gather a table, not just with our friends, but at least if we follow Jesus, with our enemies, with those unlike us, with those who are even dangerous to us, what it means for us as Christians to learn that kind of table manner, to see the table as a table that includes those folk as well. So there we are. Thank you. Hope to see you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.